Good evening, everybody, or good morning, good afternoon, wherever you may be, because we're half virtual and in person. So I'm not going to assume everybody is on the East Coast. So as Peter mentioned, we're talking about sense desire, the first of the five hindrances. And we're doing this because in the Buddha's teaching on the practice of mindfulness that we discuss all the time, being in the Satipatthana Sutta, the discourse on the foundations of mindfulness, he talks about the four foundations, right? And these four foundations are the path to overcoming suffering and the attainment of nirvana or nibbana, depending on which way you want to pronounce that. And over the past several weeks, we've been talking about the first three. So just to recap what we've been talking about, the first foundation is contemplation of the body, which I did that talk a few weeks back, which includes mindfulness of breathing, postures, contemplations of the body's real nature, and more, right? And then we had contemplations of feeling. And the word feeling here doesn't refer necessarily to emotions, but to the affective tone of experiences, whether it's pleasant, neutral, painful, that type of thing. And feeling is of special importance as an object of contemplation because feelings can serve as, for want of a better word, fodder for the defilements. And pleasant feeling can nourish greed and attachment. Painful feeling can bring on aversion. Neutral feelings can sustain delusions and can manifest itself as apathy and complacency. So contemplation of those is critical for folks who do an insight style of meditation like we do, which is Vipassana, right? Third is contemplation of the mind, which actually means observation of states of mind, since the mind in and of itself is just awareness of an object. States of mind can be distinguished through associated factors, which give them distinctive coloring. And the Buddha mentioned 16 states that were grouped in eight pairs, which were discussed last time, before the week before Peter's Q&A. So now we're starting a series of talks on the hindrances, which can be found in the fourth foundation, which is mindfulness of mental phenomena or Dhamma. And sometimes you'll see this referred to as qualities. Okay. So in here, the word Dhamma, which sometimes we may confuse with Dharma, which is the teachings with a capital D, we're referring to a group of phenomena organized in ways that reflect the goal of the Buddha's teaching. So there are five groups mentioned in the sutta that fall under this fourth foundation: five hindrances, the five aggregates, the six pairs of sense bases, seven factors of enlightenment, and the four noble truths. So this has been, if you're wondering, why am I telling you all this stuff when I'm supposed to be talking about sense desire? Because I want to bring up where we're at and where we're going, right? So of this year of teaching that we're doing, we're going through the teachings of the Buddha, basically. And with the fourth foundation, we're starting with hindrances. If we go back and look at what we've done so far with the foundations, if we think about the first one, which is the body, it's concerned with the material side of existence. The middle two are the mental side, and this last one is the exploration of experiences. And all of these four unfold in a definite sequence, starting with the body and working its way to the experiences. So, the next several weeks, we're going to be discussing the four foundations, which I've mentioned. And I wanted to use this quote from the Satipatthana Sutta, which is, "One abides contemplating mental objects as mental objects. Ardent, fully aware, mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. The Berry Center for Buddhist Studies defines mindfulness of mental phenomena as involving the systematic observation of mind objects. The various contents and qualities of your mind, as they arise, persist, and pass away. That's key, and we're going to talk about that a lot tonight, how it arises, persists, and pass away. This is, if you think about the pass away part, how we start learning more and more about impermanence. This practice, unlike the earlier ones, investigates complex psychological structures that actually shape our reality. There are 108 mental objects that are part of the fourth foundation that we investigate. 108. In the process, this manages to guide the meditator, us, through the whole curriculum of Buddhist psychology. Again, that's the five hindrances, the five aggregates, six sense spheres, seven factors of awakening, and four noble truths. So what are the five hindrances? Sensual desire or sense desire. Number two is ill will. Three is sloth and torpor. Four is restlessness and worry. And five is skeptical doubt. It's important to remember that as we explore these, and some of them may feel or make us feel, oh, I've done that. That doesn't mean we're wrong, we're bad, or at fault for having these experiences. This is part of the human condition. We have these. The Buddha knew this. He was telling us about this and then giving us solutions of how to deal with it. So be gentle with yourself as we start these studies. The hindrances can be thought of as symptoms of an underlying disconnection or dissatisfaction or suffering of old wounds, some of which could be personal, some could be familial, some could be cultural. Hindrances are impersonal. Don't attach to them. They're not us. If we can remember that they do not indicate anything about our own worth and goodness, they're easier to work with. And remember, we are meditation practitioners. We practice, we work. So as we investigate how these hindrances impact us, it's work. It's not personal. Hindrances are reactive, judgmental, and above all, they're not under our control. They're there, not our conscious control anyway. The instructions given in the sutta for bringing mindfulness to the hindrances start with recognizing when a hindrance is present and when it's not. So both. It's not a, oh, I have this hindrance and I'm just going to focus on that. No. Take a breath. When don't you have it? So our job is to recognize both. These are habitual energies and can be so familiar. They feel like part of us and part of our personality, and we take ownership of that. In our practice, we will begin to see that they are sometimes present and sometimes not, depending on the conditions we find ourselves in. And if they were part of our personality, they'd always be there in the back, right? But they're not part of us. And we have to recognize that. We don't want to take ownership, right? We want to recognize that the hindrances are hindrances and they're not our identity. We are then encouraged to actively set up conditions for the hindrances to diminish. So what's going to work for us? Everybody's individual. What's going to work for us to get the hindrances to diminish? In the sutta, the Buddha states They understand how, well, the hindrances arise, how when it's already arisen, it's given up, and how once it's given up, it doesn't arise again in the future. Our practice asks us to be skillful in how we work with these energies so that instead of giving in to them or succumbing to them, we learn to contain them, to understand what's causing them, and then to set up the conditions for them to weaken and arise less and less and less. Again, it's a practice. For us to become skillful at something, we have to practice. We're not going to be 100% successful the first time we try this because we have to practice to become skillful. Am I repeating myself? Yes. Why? Because repetition helps us remember things. We have to practice to be skillful. So let's talk about the first hindrance, sensual or sense desire. So, what is it? When I first saw that, years ago, I was like, seriously, we're going to talk about sensual desire? Okay. Sense or sensual desire is sometimes referred to as just desire or grasping. This hindrance is present when we're craving for any kind of pleasurable sense experience, and it's interrupting our peace of mind. So, how many senses do we have? Five, right? We've got five senses. So these sense desires come from our five senses, which is sight, smell, taste, touch, and hearing. Traditionally, especially with the sensual desire part in there, this discussion would focus on the dangers of lust, especially for celibate monastics, right? However, sensual desire can focus on any object that is touched on by one of the senses. It could be food, comfort, beauty, even things that we consider to be good or wholesome, like learning, human connection. Again, we're going back to we desire, we're grasping, and it interferes. That's what makes it a hindrance. It then colors our experience with that sharp ache, an ache of wanting. Have you ever felt an ache of wanting? Have you ever felt like, I just want that? And we think our life is lacking as it is because of that. And in the past, you may have heard phrases like, oh, they're keeping up with the Joneses. And I'm probably giving my age away with saying that. But giving up with the Joneses was, what do my neighbors have I don't have? Man, I wish I had that. That could be a new car. It could be a upgrade to the house, all sorts of stuff. We are a consumption-based society today. So we look at what other people have. And sometimes we want the things we don't have now, and we're desiring it and we're grasping it, thinking again how our life is lacking as it is. I know that for years, decades even, I have wanted, I don't know why, but I have always wanted a Volvo station wagon. Way before I could afford a Volvo. But I just thought they were the coolest looking cars ever. And I thought it would be great for the kids, and then great for the kids and the dogs. And now that the kids are grown, great for me and the dogs. Volvo just stopped making station wagons for the US market. Their last attempt or their last order availability was middle of January. And I was like, ooh, God, I've always wanted that. Oh, I've always wanted that. I currently drive a 2016 Subaru and a 2018 Chrysler Pacifica minivan. Okay. But I'm like, man, I really wanted that. And I told my spouse that would be my last car, my forever car. Ah, I just want that. And I had to sit because I don't spend money like that quickly. And I had to think, why? Why am I grasping for this? What's missing in my life that I think this Volvo is going to fix? Nothing's missing. I have two cars in my house. What do I need? You know, what am I going to do? Trade them both in to make the payments reasonable? What am I doing? But I grasped at that for years. That's a hindrance if I'm so focused on it, right? And I think in the last time I talked about my rheumatoid arthritis some. And I know when my RA is acting up, I crave comfort foods. Problem with that is a lot of the comfort foods I crave make my RA flare up even worse. Silly things like Pop-Tarts. I'm not 14. Why am I even thinking about Pop-Tarts? But man, a Pop-Tart sounds good when I'm in a lot of pain. Ice cream, again, not the best choice for RA. You're supposed to stay away from sugar. Sugar will help inflame you even more. But I'm craving it. Ah, and I will search the house for chocolate. Again, craving, clinging to comfort thinking, chocolate makes everything better. That's what I mean by grasping and clinging, and it's interfering with my day in my daily life and blocking my ability to meditate because I'm wandering around the house, opening cupboards, going, where's the chocolate? Where's the snacks? When I've had insomnia, again, another gift from the RA, I get so frustrated. I play video games, rationalizing that focusing on a game is better than lying in bed trying to fall asleep. In truth, I enjoy the feel of the controller in my hands. Okay, that's touch, right? That's one of the senses. And seeing my moves on the screen, my game moves. That's sight, the chocolate. What is that? That smell, that's taste. Hearing the wrapper open. Same thing with the Pop-Tart, and then hearing the toaster pop up. Those are all sense desires. If you're wondering why I'm using these examples. Now, I want everybody to take a moment, close your eyes for a second, and think about a sense desire. Or a desire or grasping that you have struggled with, and try to identify which one of your senses, and it could be more than one, that it's associated with. Did you come up with one? Maybe two? Did you come up with one that happens a lot, like me and my Pop-Tarts? Or my dark chocolate as I'm running around the house? Or are they different? Learning to identify what our sense desires are, especially if they're repetitive, helps us start the investigative process. So, what do we do to remedy sense desires and grasping and such? Is there a remedy? Yes, there's a teaching. It's fabulous that there is a teaching. It gives me hope of getting off of Pop-Tarts at my advanced age. So the first thing is renunciation that I've heard folks talk about. And that is to turn away from that distracting stimuli. My spouse would love for me to turn away from video games because They know I'm rationalizing why I'm playing. And, being stimulated, watching a screen really doesn't help insomnia. Just saying. Okay. But if we renounce and investigate that experience of the desire with mindfulness, we may feel that there's an underlying lack. Is there a loneliness? Is there boredom? A loss of purpose? And sometimes that's too painful to feel directly. So our attention seeks an outside stimuli. Upon reflection, I have come to understand my video game playing is directly related to my fear of loss of mobility of my hands as my RA progresses. So it's fear underlying my activity. I want to know. I was a music major in college. I have played instruments since second grade. I want to believe I still have the same dexterity and capacity in my hands that I did forever, which I don't. So to remedy my lack, I'm sitting in front of a video game with a controller in my hands. Fear is underlying my sense desires for touch and the visual and the auditory if I have headphones on listening to the game. Getting to something that uncomfortable is difficult. Again, we have to become skillful, which means we have to practice. As a pianist, I practiced every day for 30 minutes to an hour, depending upon my age, sometimes longer than that, as I got older. You don't improve without practice. So dealing with the hindrances, as we're going to talk about over the next several weeks, requires practice. Did I right away figure out it was fear? No. No. I didn't want to admit that there's an issue with my hands. I didn't want to delve into that. It was too painful. That's a loss of identity for me. And that's difficult to deal with. But if we can be honest with ourselves and accept that sometimes we don't get what we want and the world can be painful, it becomes easier to feel the dissatisfaction that is fueling the hindrance. Let me say that again. If we can be honest with ourselves and accept that sometimes we don't get what we want, and the world can be painful, it's easier for us to feel that dissatisfaction fueling the hindrance, which we must eventually do if we are going to uproot this habit and find freedom from constant craving. It takes time to dig down and figure out what's feeding the hindrance? When I first learned about sense desire, when I first saw anything about sense desire, I was like, oh, okay, I can figure this out. That's not hard. And that first layer is not hard. The first layer doesn't get you down to what's really behind it. Why am I sitting in front of the TV playing a video game? Why am I searching for chocolate? Why am I eating food I know is going to flare me up even worse? So, having to understand my behavior and reaction to the current things going on helps me then deal with that hindrance. I can investigate it. I can work on it. I can practice and become more skillful and facing it, which makes it less painful. And you can find freedom that way. I know that sounds weird, that it's going to be less painful if I face it. But trust me, as somebody who lives in pain, when I have a flare-up, it's excruciating. And the last thing I want to do is get up and move. But I know that getting up and moving and staying moving makes it feel better. I just have to get through those initial few steps of pain to get to the feeling better part. This is the same. I have to investigate. I have to get to the bottom and figure it out. The hindrances are obstacles to concentration. Sense desire is an obstacle to understanding and to insight. It's not that we're trying to beat it up or suppress it or deny it. We want to become aware of it. Now, I tried to deny it for a long time. Doesn't do any good. Trust me. Okay. Once you notice that this very basic impulse to want things has arisen, notice how your experience changes when you decide to let go of it. That bringing of a gentle intention of letting go to the very particular experience of sense desire is something we can do with focused awareness. And we talk about awareness a lot here. We talk about desire, we talk about grasping, we talk about mindfulness. And the hindrances is where we really start getting into how all of these play together, right? And how important they all are. So bear with me. I want to read something to you, and it's a little longer than I would normally share. But Andrew Olinsky wrote this article in the Insight Journal back in 2004. And he talks about five ways to work with the hindrance of sense desire. And I thought this was so important that I had to share it with you. So bear with me. The first thing the fourth foundation of mindfulness invites us to do as we observe mental objects as mental objects. Again, it's not part of us. It's an object. Is to be aware when there is some form of sense desire occurring in the experience. One notices and may even say subtly to oneself, there is sense desire happening. If this is what is happening in the mind, then one is to be aware of it. This sense desire does not need to be a full-blown outbreak of passionate, lustful attachment. The hindrance of sense desire is sometimes just a very subtle impulse rooted in our sensory apparatus itself to reach for an object or to reach for sensory gratification. Our body wants to feel good. Or sometimes, believe it or not, it wants to feel bad. Our eyes want to see. Our ears want to hear. Notice the wanting. Be aware of the wanting so often occurring in this present moment at this very basic level of sensation. So notice. Be aware. Number two is if you notice it is not there, notice that. In this particular moment, you are observing at least the wanting of one particular sense object or of some particular form of gratification is not there. Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. Sometimes the eye is wanting to see, and sometimes it's not. Of course, sometimes the eye is not wanting to see because the ear is too busy wanting to hear. The sutta is inviting you to explore the texture of wanting as it manifests in experience. Moreover, if you notice, and this is a third instruction, that the sense desire is not present, wait a moment, and it will arise. Whether it's not present, excuse me, when it's not present, notice how the wanting emerges gradually or suddenly. And becomes present. The very first time you notice some particular form of wanting or of sense desire, you're watching it arise in your phenomenal field. So we're noticing when it's there, we're noticing when it's not, and we're noticing when it arises. The fourth movement, excuse me, fourth movement in this exploration of the nuanced texture of sense desire is to be aware of the experience of abandoning it. Remember, the hindrances are an obstacle to concentration. Sense desire is an obstacle to understanding and to insight. It's not that we are trying to beat it up or suppress it or deny it, but we are trying to become aware of it. Once you notice that this very basic impulse to want things has arisen, notice how your experience changes when you decide to let go of it. The bringing of a gentle intention of letting go to that very particular experience of sense desire is also something that can be observed with focused awareness. And fifthly, to take it a step further, notice what attitude you can take, what intentional stance you manifest in a moment of awareness that will contribute to the non-arising of that particular sense desire. Remember, we're not working with generalities here. It is not about desire in general. Insight meditation, Vipassana meditation, the foundations of mindfulness practice are all about the details, becoming aware of the instantaneous manifestation of this particular desire for this very specific sense object. By the time you get through noticing all that, it's gone and the next one's here. As we develop and hone our ability to see ever more closely what's happening, we see more and more of these episodes of awareness arising and passing away. Close your eyes for me. What sense desire did you think about the first time? Can you picture being aware when it's there? Being aware when it's not? Recognizing when it's arising? Letting it go? Is that possible in your heart to do that? And can you do it with a gentle heart towards yourself, with some compassion, where you're not taking it on as part of you, but as a hindrance? You can open your eyes again. To recap, we have been asked to work with the hindrances of sense desire in five different ways. Notice the sense desire when it's there. Notice when it's not there. Notice as it arises. And once it's arisen, notice the texture of the intention to abandon it. The arisen sense desire does not have to rule our experience. We can let it go. And then, number five, once we've let go of it, notice how we can cultivate an attitude that will contribute to its non-arising in the next moment of experience. For me, my clinging to the Volvo has gone away. I worked through that hindrance of wanting and grasping and having to have that flipping station wagon before they stop making. It took a while. Haven't worked through the chocolate and the Pop-Tarts quite yet, but I'm still struggling on them. Keep me in your thoughts as I struggle with that. But that sound of the toaster and the wrinkle of the Pop-Tart packaging and the first taste of a hot Pop-Tart, and it's, by the way, blueberry with no frosting, is still something I'm working towards. Sense desires, five senses. Sometimes it's more than one sense at one time. Try to figure out what senses are hindering you and when. Notice, be aware. Don't bring it in as part of you. It's outside. It's a hindrance. It's blocking. Skillful practice is what we're aiming for. Thank you. Questions, concerns, thoughts?
Oh, I have a question. This is Omar.
Hey.
Hi. It's a really good talk, very insightful, very concrete, practical examples and skills to be learned. One of mine, frankly, is craving, and maybe addiction. And I heard, I follow, listen to a lot of Dharma talks from Plum Village, and one of the monks there I could relate to, he had an addiction thing as well. And he said that his seed, they talk about seeds, mental formations and these seeds being planted and watered, and you know, like for example, you're saying Pop Tarts. I like Pop Tarts too, and so you know, my seed for, I guess, sweet things or craving, is watered every time you know I eat a Pop Tart. But he's also talking about something interesting. He says his seed of addiction, or his seed of craving, was planted right next to his seed of anger or his seed of sadness. And I could relate to that. I was just wondering how you would frame that in the words that you taught today.
First, thanks for asking the question. Addiction's tough for a lot of folks, and we have different kinds of addictions, right? And addiction is an issue that if I let it would be part of my life, because I grew up with parents who have addictive personalities. And I would look at it as, like I did with my video game playing, what's underlying the addiction? And that takes work. What am I pushing down, not wanting to face, and doing this instead? For me, with the video game playing, it was accepting the fact that my body and how I looked at it at the time is betraying me. And taking who I thought I was, who I thought was an integral part of me, away, right? And so what was I stuffing down? That, my anger, my fear of how much it's going to do that. What else is it going to take away? And growing up in a family of alcoholics, what were they shoving down or hiding from or self-medicating for, whatever words you want to put there? What were they were using alcohol as a hindrance out, other med, depending on what the addiction is, right? Whether it's food, whether it's alcohol, whether it's different drugs, whether it's spending. I mean, there's a ton of different addictions out there, and Peter can talk to this so much more than I could. But we do these self-medicating things to not deal with the underlying issues. And again, the skillful work we have to do to get to those, to lessen the hold of that hindrance on us, becomes a lot of work. My mother used to have a shot of whiskey every night. Lord help. Seagram's 7. Okay. And the sound of the bottle cracking open, the straight shot pouring into the shot glass with a water chaser and getting the water ready, and the feel when it hit her mouth and would go down her throat. Think of all the senses that type of behavior touched. The feeling of the bottle, the sound of the ice, the sound of it pouring into the glass, the feeling on the tongue, the feeling on the throat. So we've got all of these different senses. And what was she not dealing with that allowed this hindrance to take control and block so many things for her? And I can't answer that. And for you, I don't know yours and don't know your situation, but I would ask myself, and I will tell you, my freshman year of college, I was having a fabulous time drinking a lot. And then a friend of mine said, do you really want to do this and go down this road? And I went and got some professional help. So I didn't go down that road because I couldn't do it alone. And now I meditate. And that helps a lot. And I make conscious decisions, mindful decisions about what I consume. And I have taught that to my children as well, because they need to know from whence they come. So that's how I would frame it in today's language. And Peter, if I missed anything, please.
Thank
Pretty
you.
well. Thank you, sir.
Got it covered. Susan mentioned this because I'm a licensed mental health professional and certified addictions counselor. So, yes, and I know about it from personal experience as well. But you described it pretty well. It's a maladaptive attempt to deal with aversion and ill will, actually. And so that's what we're confronted with. I would want to emphasize something that you made that clear, but I think it's really important, is that particularly with a substance that's pleasant, the experience of a particular substance, the sensation is very pleasant. There is a change in the body relative to the chemical of the substance, but even more important is what happens in the mind. Does it to some extent it can happen in the body. I just described how that would work, but it's really about the mind. And they talk about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and other recovery groups. The first step is fill in I came to realize that fill in the blank, whatever your addiction is, and my life had become unmanageable. Those two get conflated. There are actually two parts there. Whatever your addiction is a manifestation of of unmanageability. Alternatively, the unmanageability of the manageability of the addictive behavior is an attempt to cope with the life being unmanageable, not being capable of managing stress. And then the 11th step of the 12 steps is daily meditation and prayer. That's part of it. There's a lot more. 12 steps is a really good model. I actually did a training with someone at a Zen center up in Gainesville, Florida, about the congruence between Buddhist teachings and the 12 steps and addiction. So, yes, but you did a really good job of describing it, Susan.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Oh, appreciate the question. Other questions, comments? Don't leave a girl hanging here. Come on.
I think I could add something.
Sure.
Thanks for the talk. So, I noticed when you feel a drive towards a pleasure, and you investigate a little bit, when you feel that, sort of like you invited us to, you of course feel a pull towards the thing that you want to experience. That usually it's something that you've cycled through experiencing over and over and want to have the thing again, the goodie. But usually also I've noticed, like you with your hands on the controller, there's usually a stress response or some sort of impetus or fear that's the drive to that pleasure. So usually two things are in play, at least as far as I can tell investigating. Like there's okay, I want this. Why do I want it? If you investigate, usually you might get the sensation that, well, that's coming out of nowhere, but it's not. The more you investigate, usually there's usually something whether it's something that happened at work or a stress response or something, it's like, oh, that makes sense. Or sometimes it's an excuse. Like last week I was sick. I like food. My appetite never goes away, regardless of how sick I get. I've been on an eating plan and all this sort of stuff. But last week I was like, oh, I've got a nasty cold. Must be time for some barbecue. It's off the record. I'm sick as a dog, so that too. And the other thing I noticed is I think it's referred to a little bit in neurology as dopamine stacking, but one indulgence can lead to another. So it's like, okay, I'm doom like I ate the thing. Well, now I'm doom scrolling on my phone. Or that chain reaction, the stacking is really a thing. People sit down, like when you sit down to your video game, I bet you'd like to have a Pop-Tart. Or if I go for a walk and I see an attractive woman, I could live 5 or 10 minutes later be looking in the fridge and like, why am I looking in the fridge? Oh, I got activated. Stuff like that. So the investigation can become very interesting in that regard. But thanks for the talk.
Oh yeah, and thanks for adding to the conversation tonight. I actually when I am playing, it's more chocolate I want. But yeah, I get
Nothing
it.
beats it.
Nothing beats some good chocolate.
Yeah.
Just
About
saying.
the dopamine stacking, there's an important area of the brain called the nucleus accumbens, and it's been studied a lot in terms of addiction. And it's sort of like the trigger that gets pulled toward action, emotionally and cognitively and behaviorally. What happens with dopamine is the activating neurochemical activates the nucleus accumbens. And so when it gets stacked like that, it kind of gets stuck in the on position. And so the craving is not satisfiable, so to speak. And it can flip from one addictive behavior to another, as long as the dopamine is activated. But interestingly enough, meditation tends to tamp down the dopamine surge, noticing and letting go. Just regardless, in terms of mindfulness of breathing, just noticing and letting go, no matter what comes to mind, letting go back into the direct experience of breath and body awareness, that creates circuitry in the brain that it does a better job of regulating the nucleus accumbens. So it gets drained of its fuel. And so it's less likely to get stuck in the on position. So it's an interesting correlation there about dopamine stacking, and our culture is organized around dopamine stacking because dopamine is also active when we're scared. The nucleus accumbens is also active when we're scared in a different kind of way.
Can I ask about that?
Now, Kevin wants to ask about that.
Yes. I have a question. So once you start dopamine stacking and you start going down that path, are you suggesting that meditating is the where you said meditating is the way to counteract that dopamine stacking by, I suppose, focusing your sim finding your center and clearing that whatever's attracting you to keep going to focus on yourself and your inner mind and body rather than what was drawing you in over and over and over.
And well, part of craving and aversion, right, is the action of the dopamine system. When you're paying attention to breath awareness, mm-hmm, it's a neutral feeling, neither pleasant nor unpleasant. So dopamine surges are minimal. You know, they just don't happen. So when the dopamine is diminished in its functioning, then the whole system calms down. There still has to be some dopamine operation in order to maintain alertness. One of the aspects of sloth and torpor, another one of the hindrances, is that that whole dopaminergic system is overregulated, I guess you would say. It's not particularly effective. So intentionally watching the breath is one of the ways to regulate that dopamine surge. And you notice when your mind wants to jump to something else, there's some dopamine there. It's the normal part of the brain, like Susan was saying. But we're training to learn how to manage that system more skillfully.
And dopamine stacking has that wonderful sarcastic comment there, end effect of the crash. You know, just like if you do a sugar high or a caffeine high, at some point you're going to crash. Dopamine stacking repeatedly will result in a crash. So the other thing we have to worry about with dopamine stacking is, as with anything in abundance, we become less sensitive to it, and it requires more to have the same effect. So that can cause this up and a crash a lot, and it can also do burnout. We have reduced enthusiasm for things we used to have when we just had our regular dopamine stuff going on. Our enthusiasm is less because we've crashed so many times. So while doing something as simple as having really great music on, having some caffeine, maybe hanging out with friends all at the same time, and those all feed our pleasure centers, right? And gets our dopamine up. We do that repeatedly day after day after day. At some point, it's going to be too much and we crash. April.
Yeah, I just wanted to add from my research too, and what I teach the executive women as well, is they've actually, like, more studies are calling dopamine the motivation or the wanting molecule. So it's not always like a positive reward feeling. It's actually kind of like what you've been saying and Peter's been saying, is it just keeps driving you to do more and more and more. And then there are other neurotransmitters that are activated in that process. So cortisol and adrenaline, and then that makes the body more jittery. And the other thing we know is that meditation increases GABA, and that's the calming, you know, hormone and the calming feeling in the body. And Peter, like what Peter was saying, if you have too much of it, then you can experience some sloth and torpor. But it's very interesting. And as somebody who used to be high on, like, New York City and alcohol and music and performance and all the hindrances, I could definitely say that years of meditation have absolutely helped me to feel very regulated and content with a relatively low stimulation lifestyle at this point. Mm-hmm. So I think it is really remarkable how we can reset our modes, you know, like our brain, our habits, and how the neurotransmitters are circulating.
And that goes back to skillful practice, right?
Yes.
Let me make another comment about that, because what happens is, as the system gets stacked, we need more and more stimulation to feel the same. Mm-hmm. Or it seems that way. It's not really that way. But what happens when the mind becomes more balanced, that there's a, you know, a really effective cooperative interaction between the activating neurochemistry and the sedating neurochemistry. There's a balance point, and there still could be a great sense of happiness, even kind of a rush experience, just from looking at a flower or playing with your dog. You know, it doesn't require something that's chemically driven or repeated in such a way like playing a computer game. That's important to understand that this practice, the payoff for this practice, is the more you cultivate serenity, the more joy comes with it. Well, we'll talk about that when we talk. Those are two of the awakening factors, joy and serenity or tranquility.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that, yeah, I experienced more joy with the practice than with, late night New York City and all of that, even though that stuff was super fun. But yeah, it's definitely true. Anyway, thank you.
And Sharon, I think you were wanting to say something.
I'm really enjoying hearing everybody else. I was going to say, I had a lot of thoughts, Susan, when you were talking. And I'm thinking, why even buy the Pop-Tart and have it so close to you within reach? Because, that's a part of the process for me. If I buy it, then I'm even more likely to indulge. And I'm appreciating, I'm thinking of the chemicals in the body, but not as technically as Peter and April and the people who are well informed of the dopamine. But I remember, well, it's not chocolate, really. Have you ever eaten really high content chocolate? Because you can, and it is
Addictive.
almost. No, I'm saying not addictive without the sugar, because chocolate that's 100% or very high content chocolate is not pleasurable, really.
No, it's pretty bitter.
It does affect your nervous system, your hormonal system.
It does. Is that Peter? You're saying
Yeah.
it?
Yeah.
It's the well, you're saying it does or does not. The high content.
Pure chocolate was regulated when it first started to be imported into Great Britain. That only the rich could afford it, but they had to be very careful about it because when it's in its pure form, its bitterness, it can be very stimulating. And so part of the thing they did was to put sugar into it and other chemicals, you know, milk and all that stuff. Modified it.
Well, yeah, and I mean, I think I can easily indulge and overindulge myself, and it's about being present and recognizing that urge to consume it. And I guess a part of the practice would be to be aware of, oh, the craving. It's really a craving
Right.
for me. And
Let
if
me
I
offer
stop, and I just want to say stop.
We're getting close
When
to
I
the
stop,
end.
yeah,
right.
We're getting close to the end of our meeting time tonight. So let me just make a final comment. I used to counsel people who had an eating disorder, a food addiction, that they knew that when they were driving home, there would be a particular trigger that would get them. Maybe they would bring you from work or whatever, but they would had their favorite spot where they would stop and get, I don't know, some chocolate, right? And I would say to them, you can contemplate, I have this feeling about stopping to get the chocolate, but I don't really have to stop. And that might work, but maybe you do stop. You could sit in the parking lot and contemplate that urgency just as a feeling. I don't really have to act on this urge. I can drive away anytime I want. If that's unsuccessful, then you go in the store. And in the store, you say to yourself, okay, I'm feeling it again. I really don't have to buy this. I can decide to stop and go home. So it becomes a whole series of experiments in learning how to be mindful of urgency and learn how to let it flow through without being hooked by it and swept along. And breath body awareness is the primary foundation for that.
And Sharon, I will say, I don't have the Pop-Tarts in my house, but DoorDash is my friend. So I have to stop the urge to just DoorDash them to my house when I'm having that moment of, I just don't care what it does to me. So
at that point, it's useful to contemplate. At that point, it's useful to contemplate sitting with what it is that makes you want to contact DoorDash, which is what you were talking about before.
Yes, so. Yes, indeed. Before Peter...
Can I say one quick thing about smoking? Because people who have an addiction to smoking, one of the things that I did was when I had that craving and not have a cigarette in my hand, I would inhale like I would a cigarette and then exhale as though I were exhaling a cigarette. So that's the breathing part that substitutes the actual consumption. And Peter, you reminded me when you made your comment of that.
Yep, that's a good idea.
Yeah. I like that. So before Peter sends us off, I just want to challenge everybody here to try the first two tools, right? Notice a sense desire when it's there and notice when it's not. I have personally found the second one to be most difficult for me. But I challenge you this week.
What you'll notice is what prompts the first one.
Right.
And you sit with that.
Right. But try that this week coming up before the next talk about the next hindrance, which is next week. So, Peter, to you, sir.
Okay. Allie, you're going to talk to us about aversion and ill will next week, right?
Yes. Looking forward to it.
Yes, so am I. All right, so it's our custom at the end of the meeting for us to sit together briefly in silence. Let's do that. Thank you for your practice. Wish you well. Hope that we're all reasonably safe and happy till the next time we have a chance to chat.